You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. Caroline Hyde is off today. This is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up, we have full market coverage ahead as investors scale back on geopolitical concerns with stocks bouncing off their lows. Plus, Netflix shares fall after a disappointing revenue outlook and plans to stop reporting its subscriber numbers. Details to come. And financial services platform Ramp raises an additional $150 million to reach a $7.6 billion valuation with new backer Coastal Ventures. We sit down exclusively with CEO Eric Lyman later this hour. Let's get to those markets. We know the themes. Geopolitical concern, kind of some caution, if not risk-off mentality. Israel with a muted retaliatory strike against Iran. We will go to DC in just a moment and discuss the politics of it and operationally what's happening. NASDAQ 100 is down a full percentage point. Tech is actually where there is the most downward pressure right now. There are other stories within that. And on the board, you'll see names like Tesla and Netflix. Tesla with the Cybertruck recall. I'll give you the details later in the program. Netflix had a mega start to the year, but the investor base is spooked by its outlook for the future and how it plans to communicate. I'm also looking at crude. We did see oil move higher based on what happened in the Middle East. That's not hugely a surprise. Let's get to the top story. Israel launched a retaliatory strike on Iran less than a week after Tehran's rocket and drone barrage. Iranian media appeared to downplay the incident in the hours that followed the initial reports. For more, let's get out to Washington, D.C. and Bloomberg Balance of Power host Kaylee Lyons. This is the framing. It is a retaliation, but muted, and seems to be that Israel listened to the United States, who were urging them to show restraint.
Yeah, and Ed, not just the United States, but other allies and partners as well, including officials from the UK and Germany, which actually made a trip to Israel earlier this week to encourage Prime Minister Netanyahu to have restraint here in the response to that unprecedented attack we saw Iran conducting over last weekend, where, of course, the more than 300 missiles and drones sent Israel's way were largely intercepted by air defenses by not just Israel and other allies. Now, Iranian media have confirmed that there was a drone attack in Isfahan where there was a military operation. However, it did not actually hit any nuclear facilities, according to our understanding at the moment. And that perhaps could have been one of the most escalatory things of all. It does not seem that that happened. Instead, that this was relatively a limited strike with very little damage that seems to have resulted from it. U.S. officials have confirmed to Bloomberg that Israel was behind this attack. Israel, as is typical in military operations relating to Iran, has not confirmed or denied it, not commenting at all. And the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, also, who was at a G7 meeting in Italy, didn't directly comment on this attack, but did go out of his way to say that the U.S. has not been involved in any offensive operations and remains committed to de-escalation between Israel and Iran, knowing, of course, that the U.S.'s primary objective throughout this entire saga that really has taken place not just in the most immediate past, but since October 7th, when Hamas first attacked Israel, is to have this not spread into a wider conflict. Right now, the signal from both Israel and Iran does not seem to be that they are interested in escalating this further. The sign seems to be that Iran is not immediately inclined to launch another counterstrike against Israel for this, as Iranian media is saying largely this strike was unsuccessful.
I'm just passing over the markets later in the program, Kaylee. We're going to do a deep dive on Bitcoin. And I thought that actually the reaction over a sort of 24-hour time period was interesting, kind of came down. I think we're back up in the session. The NASDAQ 100 on the equity side, it is the kind of mega cap tech names that are pushing lower on a points basis. They're a big drag on the index. My point being, markets are trying to work out how serious this is. Mm-hmm. Operationally, the only kind of update that I've seen is from Secretary Blinken, who in summary basically said, you know, the United States did not participate. But do we have any sense of strategy here on the U.S. side, given how they've operated in a basically advisory capacity in this situation so far?
Well, the U.S. has been quite clear that they will stand by their ironclad commitment to Israel as an ally and act in Israel's defense, as we saw last weekend when it was U.S. air defense that also contributed alongside the U.K. and Jordan to making sure that the vast majority of those drones and missiles did not actually end up in Israeli airspace. But that is really where the U.S. seems to have drawn the line. Yes, we will help defend you. However, we will not join you in any offensive operations. It was widely reported that when President Biden spoke to Netanyahu after last weekend's attack, he suggested that he should take the win, essentially not go any further, and that the U.S. would not be joining them if the Israelis decided to counterattack against Iran. Again, it seems that Israel has decided to do so, but in a limited fashion, and it's been very clear messaging from the Secretary of State that the U.S. was not involved in any particular offensive attack, including this one, Ed.
There is a lot happening in D.C. At the moment and in the coming week. You know, we're going to be talking a lot about TikTok. How much of the focus has been captured by the situation in the Middle East, both at the sort of federal level in the White House and through Congress as well?
Well, a great deal, Ed, especially considering that Congress, as we speak, is getting ready to advance supplemental aid for other allies too, including Ukraine and Taiwan, but billions of dollars in aid for Israel. It's working its way through the House. We expect a procedural vote will happen on the House floor today to advance that for a full floor vote tomorrow, either in the late afternoon or evening, which would then go on to the Senate and presumably be signed by President Biden in the not-so-distant future. So the U.S. is actively thinking about the military support that it is providing allies. This has been a bit of a difficult journey, especially because the Ukraine aid itself has been complicated. But I would just note that there's other political factors, specifically with the Middle East here, including very high domestic pressure on President Biden from within the progressives in his own party, who also are not very supportive of the Israeli operation that we have seen in Gaza, given the high death toll of Palestinians, which authorities in Gaza say has now surpassed 34,000. So at the same time that the U.S. has been coming to the defense of Israel in the case of Iran, wants to make sure Israel is secure, it also has been putting a lot of pressure on the Netanyahu government to take higher accounts of the civilian toll of this war, to make it easier to get humanitarian aid in, has been encouraging them not to conduct an operation in the city of Rafah, where there are remaining Hamas battalions, until they can safely evacuate the more than 1,000 Palestinian civilians that are there. So it's been a very difficult dance for the U.S. to still be supportive of Israel, stand behind it as an ally, but also try to exercise some leverage to change Israeli policy, perhaps, in regard to its ongoing war with Hamas.
Bloomberg's Kaylee Lyons in D.C., just terrific and deep reporting on what is a geopolitical situation. But just looking purely at the index level, NASDAQ 100, super tech heavy, it's the mega cap tech names that are dragging us down, and they're really underperforming the benchmark S&P 500, and the Dow is actually in positive territory. That's why we're focused there. The reaction in the markets is being felt in tech right now.
This remotely operated vehicle offers a glimpse into what lies thousands of meters underwater. It's one of several deep-sea vehicles on board this repurposed ship from Ray Dalio's philanthropic venture.
The Ocean Explorer behind me that's currently docked in Singapore will set off on its mission very soon to explore the deep waters of Southeast Asia. There's lots of advanced tech at play here, like this remotely controlled underwater vehicle that can go 6,000 meters deep to collect data. and these submersibles that can take passengers as deep as 1,000 meters underwater.
The vessel was once used in the oil and gas sector, but the revamped diesel-electric ship now travels around the world, collaborating with governments and working with local scientists. It's in Southeast Asia to study the region's marine environment in an attempt to protect the oceans from the effects of climate change.
Just such deep reporting on marine propulsion navigation. Bloomberg's Ainsley Asakan with that report. Okay, let's get to talking tech. And in the news, Apple is pulling Meta's WhatsApp from its app store in China amid orders from Beijing to close more loopholes in the country's long-standing internet firewall. The iPhone maker also removed the messaging services Telegram and Signal, according to consultants who are tracking that space. Plus, sticking with Meta, the social giant has unveiled a new version of its powerful Llama artificial intelligence model. Llama 3 is an upgrade from an AI model that Meta released last summer, and it's the latest effort to keep pace with similar technologies from companies like OpenAI and Google. And finally, Apollo and Sony are considering a joint offer for Paramount Global. According to sources, the two firms have held discussions about teaming up on an offer, but have not yet submitted an official proposal. Sony and Apollo's entry would complicate a deal that's already in the works for the studio, which is currently holding exclusive talks with Skydance Media. Stick with media. Digging into Netflix, shares falling after earnings. But Needham & Co. actually upgrading Netflix today to buy from hold with an updated price target, $700. Laura Martin, senior entertainment and internet analyst over at Needham & Co., is here with us live. Bloomberg Technology. I really enjoyed your note. Hello, good morning, happy Friday. Not so happy based on Netflix share response. The anxiety, I think, is the idea that they just won't report monthly subscriber gains or losses. Why?
So I think it's a great point. I mean, first of all, they're not going to do it until the first quarter of 25. So all of this year, we're sort of safe. Second, I'm fairly skeptical they can do this because other than Apple, which I do not think Netflix is Apple, every company that has a subscriber-driven business reports subscribers because we calculate value on a per-subscriber basis. So I don't know if they'll actually do away with it, even though they've said they will. They're pretty good about listening to feedback, and Wall Street's feedback is pretty negative about this, like, opaqueness that they're adding to the fundamentals. So, but anyway, it's not an issue until the first quarter of 25 at the earliest. I also think people are having issues with sort of below, like a negative sub add number compared to first quarter. They don't like that. And also the guidance for Q2 is a little light compared to consensus estimates. So I think people are worried about a slowdown in revenue growth.
I like the phrasing opaque. I mean, Netflix management's thing has always been like, judge us on these traditional financial metrics, you know, profit basically. What I found interesting, if you look at the 9.33 million customers added in the first quarter, there's a story behind it, right? Which is that the password crackdown seemed to bring to them people that were forced to sign up for their own account, and they were willing to do that. What was your interpretation of that number in the moment?
So I also think that what's happening is when someone calls to disconnect because they're angry that they're going to have to buy a whole another subscription or that the price is going up, with the ad-driven tier, instead of canceling your $15 subscription that's on its way to $20, you can go to a $7 per month tier. You just have to take ads. But right now, they tell us at Netflix that they don't have that many ads, that they have way more supply of ad units available to sell than they do have demand for ad units, which means the ad loads here are very minimal, like one or two ads an hour. So that's a pretty good deal for consumers right now because you can pay $7 a month and get almost no ads in what's called the ad tier. So 3 years from now, there'll be 5 minutes of ad loads. But today, there's like 1 minute of ad loads and you're paying $7. I think that is helping their reported sub number. Although it's hurting the what they call ARM, what the rest of the world calls ARPU, because the average the subscriber that used to disconnect and go to zero is now going to $7. So it's pulling down the average revenue per subscriber as people sign up for these ad-driven tiers.
Just a quick update for our Bloomberg Technology audience, Laura. I just wanted to talk about the shares really quickly. We're down more than 8% off session lows, but at one point, the stock was on track for its biggest drop since April of 2022. let's see where we end up at the end of the day. I don't understand why we don't talk a little bit more about the strength of the content slate. I have just finished watching The Gentlemen, for example, the TV or series adaptation of the Guy Ritchie film. Thought it was good for what it's worth. But content-wise, continuity-wise, Netflix seems to be okay. Why are we not discussing that more?
I think because Wall Street sort of feels that's their, they make widgets, right? Their widget happens to be content. We assume they're going to do a good job of that with the $17 billion a year that public shareholders give them. We expect them to maximize the quality of that $17 billion of content. We sort of think that's their core business. Like, just because Apple makes great phones, like, you don't give them kudos for that. Like, they better make great phones. Otherwise, people aren't going to keep the service. So I think that's their core business. And I also think Wall Street is skeptical of hit-driven businesses, because you may love The Gentlemen, which I also thought was excellent content, but somebody else wants to watch The Kardashians on a different service. Like, you know, what quality content is to different people is different. And so, you know, what we care about on Wall Street is what's happening with the return on investment for the $17 billion of content. And I will tell you, sports is really important to Wall Street. And I think it's really important to these streaming services. So they are doing more with sports. As you saw on the call, there's a lot of talk about this big fight that's coming up. They've now signed up WWE to do live sports. Let's call it entertainment sports.
Yes.
Every week for next year. That's a big deal. They are softening on sports, but they also said they are not going to spend any more money on sports. They're going to have to, the sports fees will have to come out of the $17 billion in total content costs. That's really important. I think they need to be in news also.
Laura, we got to go with some breaking news, but we'll have you back to talk Gen AI and the context of Netflix. Thank you. This is the breaking news. First of all, in the House, the Ukraine aid and TikTok bills have cleared the procedural hurdle in the House that we were waiting for. Separately, on the Senate floor, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is speaking and saying that lawmakers should plan to work this weekend to take up the Ukraine aid bill quickly, and we'll keep an eye on TikTok. Those are stories we're tracking here on Bloomberg Technology. We'll be right back. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Let's go back to those breaking news headlines out of Washington, D.C. In the House, the Ukraine aid and TikTok bills have cleared a key procedural hurdle. Separately, out of the Senate, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking, saying that lawmakers should plan to work this weekend. In the context of the TikTok bill, the divest or ban bill, that's one that we've been tracking on this program because we're trying to understand the cadence of how quickly that could be ratified, if at all. I think my colleague and friend, Bloomberg's Kayleigh Lyons, host of Balance of Power, is good and joins us from Washington, D.C. I was trying to parse two things happening in parallel, Kayleigh, from the House and the Senate. What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, Ed, this was a massive bipartisan majority that this procedural vote advanced under. It was more than 300 members of the House, to be exact, 316, who voted for passage of the rule, which will clear the way tomorrow for them to pass one by one this series of bills. It will likely happen over the course of Saturday afternoon to evening. One bill that will have more than $60 billion in military aid for Ukraine, billions more in a separate bill for Israel, and then a separate one for the Indo-Pacific. And that will be a fourth bill as well, which we are calling the sidecar here in Washington. That includes a variety of other measures, including that divestiture bill relating to TikTok, Ed, as well as others like the Repo Act, which will allow for the seizure of frozen Russian assets that could be used to pay for Ukraine's war effort. So once all of this passes the House, presumably there's going to be two key questions. One is, how quickly can it be repackaged together to be sent to the Senate for passage to get to the desk of President Biden for a signature? And also, what will happen to the House Speaker Mike Johnson as a result of this? He has been under tremendous pressure from a few members of his Republican conference who do not want to see Ukraine aid go to the floor of the House for a vote. One of the most outspoken has been Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has filed a motion to vacate, which is what ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy just months ago, has not yet acted on it, but has long signaled she could if indeed he put Ukraine aid on the floor. So we're going to wait to see for action on that. Other members, including Republican Congressman Tom Massey, have suggested they will join her in that effort. However, Ed, and this is where it gets really interesting, it took Democrats to get this rule passed, to get it over the finish line now, and it does seem that Democrats may step in to help save the gavel of Speaker Mike Johnson if it proves necessary. There's been a lot of talk here in Washington this morning about this kind of being like a coalition government, because Mike Johnson is relying on the other party to basically get everything over the line and potentially might be relying on them to help him keep his job.
That's kind of focused on the House level. Let's take a moment here. There's a lot happening and there are a lot of headlines. In parallel, Chuck Schumer in the Senate is saying that lawmakers should plan to work this weekend as needed. You know, there will be audience members around the world, but particularly around the country in the United States, saying, why are they working through the weekend on this? Why is it so important?
Well, because this aid is desperately needed. If you listen to U.S. intelligence officials, and I was speaking with the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Mike Turner, just last night, who was suggesting that it needed to pass this week based on the intel they are getting on the ground in Ukraine. Just procedurally, because of the way the House works and the requirement that members have to have 72 hours to read the bill, because of when the text is released, they can't actually have the vote until Saturday night. Now, the Senate is going to very want to quickly take this up, which could mean that they take it right as soon as the House passes it and begin to do the procedural work in the Senate to get this over the finish line, which may be why they end up staying the weekend. I would also point out that the Senate tonight is facing a midnight deadline of the expiration of FISA, the Foreign Surveillance Act, which of course has been passed in the House, has been running into some hurdles in the Senate as well, and that could potentially lapse for a bit at midnight if they can't figure out a way to get the unanimous consent needed to advance that. So it could be a working weekend for everyone, which is probably not going over well for some, considering they were supposed to leave on recess beginning today. There were a number of members who were scheduled to be on congressional delegations to a number of different localities, and instead they may stay here to get this work done, Ed.
Okay, so it sounds like we're in for a busy weekend, probably you more so than I, out here in San Francisco. Is there anything we should be watching for this Friday afternoon?
Well, I would watch what happens in the Senate related to FISA in particular, whether they can reach some kind of agreement on amendment votes or things of that nature to make sure that this can indeed get over the finish line by the deadline. But really watch what happens in the House now that this rule has advanced, to see if we actually see any action from Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, to launch the process to vacate the speaker, and what could unfold from there. Also, given that there are so many things attached to this, including the TikTok bill, which did pass by a wide bipartisan majority in the House originally, now has a revision that would allow ByteDance longer than 6 months to divest it, potentially up to a full year, which may make it easier to digest in the Senate, where many had issue with the original bill. But just look to see now that the TikTok measure does appear to be on track for passage in the House, whether there anyone is vocal in the Senate suggesting that they don't like the fact that this is attached to the package. So it'll kind of be just digging into the nuances of who may be upset. Yes. Here, even as vast bipartisan majorities seem to be liking what they're seeing and looking to advance this, Ed.
Bloomberg's Katie Lyons, thank you. Aid and TikTok bills, we'll keep a close eye on. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. We should talk about Bitcoin. And it's interesting because Bitcoin has its own story in the markets, which is the halving. And we will have a deep discussion about that in just a moment. But if you look at the trading of Bitcoin, which trades 24/7 over the last 24 hours, it tells you an interesting story about that asset in the context of geopolitics and volatility in markets. So when the headlines first started to come out Thursday evening, US time, about a Israel retaliation in Iran, there was this clear downward move on Bitcoin. Actually, in the session, we're now up higher and on a two-day basis up 6%. All told, Bitcoin just south of $65,000 per token. Then there's the other big story. The hotly anticipated Bitcoin halving is approaching. Here's what our Bloomberg guests have had to say about the event.
Every time we come up to one of these halving events, it really does come back to the fundamentals of supply and demand.
The crypto industry goes through a cycle. It's to be expected. There's going to be market volatility. It doesn't only impact the asset front. I mean, given the geopolitical tension, given the interest rate environment that we are seeing, the inflationary environment.
Obviously, Bitcoin and crypto right now in general is part of the global financial system. So we are not completely disconnected from what's happening in equities, for example, and what's happening with monetary policy or with what's happening in the geopolitical environment.
We've been preparing for many years. You know, our business is one that requires long-term planning, and these halvings are known events. And so the evolution of mining has really changed since previous halvings, where we had a really fragmented market.
I think a lot of investors are eagerly anticipating to see what the market reaction will be.
Joining us now is Kavita Gupta, Delta Blockchain Fund General Partner. Just deep expertise in the underlying technology that supports digital assets. Also, some pretty strong awareness of what's happening in markets. Kavita, just forgive me. I'm going to go back to basics here. I've said the word halving. Some people call it a halvening many times. And I'm going to cheat. I'm just going to read the Bloomberg definition of what it is. And then you can tell me whether it's important or not. A halving, sometimes referred to as a halvening, is a planned reduction in the rewards miners receive. Halvings happen once every 4 years or every 210,000 blocks. Just for awareness out there, are you really excited about this, Kavita?
I think excitement may not be the word I would be using. What does Bitcoin halving really mean? It just means that it makes it more difficult for the miners to have the rewards associated with mining. And also definitely that results in having mining difficulties. Basically, you have to put more energy, more complicated theorems out there. And it basically ultimately increases the cost of mining. That's what we are looking at. It is important because it makes sure that it is much more secure, mining is secure, all the Bitcoin layer is secure. Now, this definitely gets a lot of attention because of the price movement, the expected, especially now with the expected ETF, which has already happened. Now, for the first time, we're going to expect a new price curve because the supply and the demand curve for Bitcoin has been very unique this time. The supply has been huge. Usually what we see that before Bitcoin halving and around Bitcoin halving, a lot of people start putting Bitcoins out. So the supply has been there, but the demand has been so high that we see volatility instead of the straight curves down or up. So it is exciting in that way.
You make a really interesting point, which is basically one of liquidity. It's quite a liquid market. And the counter argument is that there will always be a finite supply of Bitcoin, a definitive number. And that is largely what those that build a thesis of Bitcoin reaching a much higher number in the long term rely on. Are those people in that camp correct?
I absolutely believe that at the end of the day, Bitcoin has a lot of value. And even though it is more difficult to now produce and the supply is going to be more and more limited, but that's what we see with most of the commodities, whether it's gold, whether it's platinum, silicon, anything which has limited supply, but a lot of value long run, especially storage value like Bitcoin has been considered now. It's just going to increase the price. You will see volatility, which you still see in gold today. But the value is just infinite and for a very long period of time.
Kavita Gupta, Delta Blockchain Fund General Partner, someone investing at the technology level, but I just really appreciate your market insights. Thank you. There's another big story out there today in the world of EV, and I want to talk about Tesla. The EV maker recalled over 3,800 Cybertrucks to rework or replace accelerator pedals that can dislodge and cause the vehicle to unintentionally accelerate, which increases the risk of a crash. Tesla received notice of two customer claims related to that issue, and that's all according to a recall report submitted to the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA. The company said that when high force is applied to the Cybertruck's accelerator, the pedal may dislodge and become trapped by the interior trim. Tesla is going to fix the accelerator pedals free of charge. For me, the other big thing about this story is we now know how many Cybertrucks are out there in the wild and how many have been delivered to customers, which is quite interesting. Tesla shares basically flat. All right, coming up on Bloomberg Technology, we're going to be joined by Ramp CEO Eric Glyman to discuss their new fundraise. There are some big numbers and there's an interesting conversation ahead. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not and, as simple you know, as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Okay, a lot of people talking about this one. Financial services platform Ramp just raised an additional $150 million for its Series D round, part two, at a valuation of around $7.6 billion with a new backer, Coastal Ventures. Delighted to bring in Ramp CEO, Eric Glyman, out in New York. And this is a really interesting round. The venture firm leading it was Coastal Ventures, but Keith Raboy, who recently rejoined Coastal on the East Coast, kind of spearheaded this. Just explain the rationale behind doing the round.
I mean, there's a couple of things that, and by the way, thank you so much for having me. First, the rationale is the company is growing and we aim to accelerate it. Not only is Ramp one of the fastest growing businesses in U.S. history, but investors were deeply exciting. Keith the most, who's one of our board members, who saw the business at its large scale accelerating in growth. Typically, they tend to slow down as they grow. The rationale is to increase the pace of customers that we serve. We power over approximately 1% of all corporate car transactions in America. We want to serve the next 99%, but more than that, it's a high conviction bet, both by investors and by Ramp, to transform the way finance is done from highly manual, very tedious, to increasingly automated and leveraging the potential of AI to bring it to the average business.
Eric, you previously came on the show when you guys had done a down round, and you were really honest about the willingness to do a down round. This is an up round, and I just wondered how you think about the dynamic this time around.
I mean, for sure. I mean, look, I think that for all companies, being valued mark to market is a very good thing. Over the last summer, part of what we recognized is that it was really the fastest interest rate rise in really a 40-year period. And so even though Ramp had at that time grown by leaps and bounds, I think between rounds it had grown by seven times over a year and a half period, we wanted to be valued fairly. Fast forward to now, just months later, Ramp's business has grown dramatically and investor conviction has increased. And so we're thrilled that some of the best investors in the world, from public markets investors to extraordinary privates like Coastal Ventures, Founders Fund, Sequoia, Greylock, and others joining for the first time, they're thrilled for where Ramp is. But I think to invest at this valuation for the first time at this juncture, there is a high conviction belief that there is not just a 15% plus growth per year ahead of Ramp, but there is 10x plus more ahead. And so we're thrilled.
Eric, for the Bloomberg Technology audience member that's less financially inclined, mark to market meaning the method of getting fair value by benchmarking contemporaneously against similar companies. So I noticed on social media a lot of people were talking about your round. And so I went on social media and said you were coming on the show. And our audience on Bloomberg Technology actually had some pretty good and straightforward questions. One of them was, Eric, can you just simply explain what Ramp is and what it does? Which I thought was a pretty good starting point.
Of course. So the way to think about it, we built a command and control system for companies' finances. What this means is from a single place, company finance teams, business owners can issue cards, make payments of all kinds, manage approvals, and even automate accounting to close their books. And so this means that some of the tedious aspects, things like collecting receipts, tagging transactions properly, is done automatically for you. We surface up data in ways for companies to spend less. And the upshot is that the average company using Ramp is able to reduce their expenses by 5% per year, whether that's a publicly traded scale like a Shopify to earlier stage to even nonprofits like the Boys and Girls Club of America. And I think really what's different and interesting about Ramp is it's not only the tools and bones to make payments, but it is focused on how can you make people more productive with their time instead of having expense reports take, you know, an hour at the end of a month, have it be done for you and get your time back to focus on your core business. So that's how we think about it.
Eric, the other audience question I got for you was about you. You are generally regarded as a very nice person. I hear that a lot in my circles, at least out west as well. But the question from the audience was, are you needing to be a bit more ruthless at this stage of the company's growth as a founder CEO that's now playing at a pretty high level valuation-wise and scale-wise?
For us, look, the broader backdrop is I actually think the U.S. business environment has gotten much more mean and nasty for the average business owner. Most companies are reducing their investment in their products. They're hiking the prices. The value they're offering and the service level is going down. We want to lean in and doing the right thing. Having more capital allows us to not just be nice, but frankly, offer better service. And the last time, Ed, we were on the show, we were saving the average company on the order to 3-4% per year. We want to extend that idea of maybe, as you put it, being nice. We want the average company to save 5%, to be more productive. And we think over time, doing right by customers is what creates long-lasting and enduring businesses. And so it's not just a personality. We think it's a good way of doing business.
Well, you also now have a couple more investors that you'll have to account to along the way as well. Ramp CEO Eric Glyman, it's great to catch up and have you back on the program. Thank you. Let's stick with the world of venture and startups. Maven Ventures, a seed stage venture firm investing in consumer tech companies, announced $60 million in new capital for its latest fund. It brings the firm's total assets to $200 million. Let's bring in Sarah Deshpande, general partner at Maven Ventures, in today's VC Spotlight. This was interesting. A sizable seed fund coming together. Was it a smooth process, Sarah?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here today. We're really excited to bring this new seed fund to the world. Maven Ventures is best known for investing in tech companies that are addressing emerging consumer trends. And consumer trends never go away. So that's an area that we've continued to be excited about. And, you know, I won't lie, this has been the hardest funding market for startups and venture capital firms alike. So to be able to close a $60 million vehicle, it's our fourth and latest fund, we think is really a testament to our strategy, to the market opportunity. And we're grateful to our founders and LPs for continuing to have their trust in us.
Sarah, it's so hard because if you just split technology into hardware and software, you know, the companies that are working on consumer-facing application in both domains are giant. You're trying to get the disruption at the earliest possible stage. How do you make it worthwhile?
We really look at emerging consumer trends and technology companies that are fueled by those big consumer trends. And so that's what we're looking for, especially in today's universe where you see the bloom of AI technology. There have been so many companies invested in B2B, in infrastructure, in foundational models of AI, that we think now is the time for those consumer opportunities to bloom. We also take a really wide lens of what means consumer to us. You know, we were known for our early investment in Zoom, and no company was a more consumer company than Zoom in the year of 2020. So for us, we're looking at what are these new points of technology? What are these new emerging trends? And can we find and partner with visionary, bold founders that we think we can help to unlock their potential to bring these iconic companies to the world? So that consumer lens is actually for us quite broad.
Sarah, what is the number one emerging consumer trend?
The number one consumer trend right now is consumer applications of AI. Where do we think AI can actually deliver on the grand dream of doing something for a consumer, of, you know, making something of value for consumers that actually brings something positive to their lives? So that's the biggest area we're looking at, but it applies across so many sectors. It can apply across, you know, technology for families. It can apply across, you know, search. It can apply across anything that might plan or book something on your behalf. So there's a pretty wide range of sectors that consumer AI touches, and that's where we're spending our time right now.
I think that you saying AI was not a huge surprise to many people. Sarah Deshpande, general partner at Maven Ventures. Great to have you on the show. Thank you.
It's not the legislation that we would write if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, and the White House. This is the best possible product that we can get under these circumstances to take care of these really important obligations.
U.S. House Speaker Johnson has just been talking about votes on foreign aid bills. Bloomberg's Katie Lyons is back in D.C., and I think it is around Speaker Johnson that the latest headlines involve.
Yeah, of course, what we saw happen on the House floor today, Ed, was a procedural vote advancing that will pave the way for funding for U.S. allies to pass the House later Saturday. These are four separate bills, one for Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, and a so-called sidecar, which is attaching other measures, including the TikTok divestiture bill. All of this aimed at getting more than $95 billion in aid to U.S. allies. However, it does seem that the House Speaker could face a threat to his job as a result. This has long been threatened by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had suggested if Johnson were to put Ukraine aid on the floor for a vote, she would act on her motion to vacate, essentially trying to kick him out of the job. Already one other member, Republican Congressman Tom Massie, had joined her in that effort. And now, according to a statement from Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona, he too has added his name in support of the motion to vacate. So now that's three members of the Republican conference. We're working to identify that Gosar statement or verify it independently, as this has been reported by other outlets. But of course, this suggests, because of the way the math works in the House, Ed, and how tight the margin is, that it will require Democrats to show up and support the Speaker so that he is able to keep hold of the gavel. Whether or not that's just not showing up to a new an ouster vote, whether that is actually outright voting for him, we'll see what form it takes, but it will require help from Democrats to save his job, just as it took massive Democratic support to get this procedural vote over the line today.
There is math on the votes and the bills, and then there's procedure, which you explained really well earlier in the show. We were talking about how Majority Leader Schumer in the Senate had put lawmakers on notice to be working this weekend. Just explain why the pressure to work through the weekend on these bills.
Well, the Senate won't have a chance to act on these bills until the House passes all of them, repackages them together, and sends them to the Senate for a vote. And the way the rules in the House are structured and what was agreed to when Kevin McCarthy was Speaker all those months ago was that members had to have 72 hours to read the text of a bill before a vote. And because the text of this bill was released less than 72 hours ago, it cannot be voted on until Saturday. So even though that we've seen the rule vote today, which essentially just sets the procedure for how this ultimately will pass when it comes to final package, the House isn't going to be able to clear all of this until Saturday afternoon, perhaps evening, and then the Senate would be able to act after. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said they will do so quickly, which is why they may be staying in town. This may be a Sunday vote or later. And of course, keep in mind, Ed, that in the U.S. Senate, what is required to do anything quickly is unanimous consent. Any one senator, should they so choose, has the ability to slow down the process. So someone like Senator Rand Paul, for example, if he takes issue with this bill, could refuse to accelerate the process until he has a vote on an amendment or something like that. So it'll be a matter of how quickly the Senate can get this done after the House completes its work this weekend.
Kayleigh, just very quickly, the situation in the Middle East, is that impacting the passage of any of these bills?
It is, Ed. When you first saw the Iranian attack against Israel, the more than 300 missiles and drones that were sent toward Israel last weekend, you heard an outcry that this underscored the need to get aid for Israel out the door quickly. Of course, that has been attached in large part to aid for other allies, including Ukraine, which has been a much more difficult endeavor. But there also had been growing calls to make sure that the aid for Ukraine comes through quickly, as intelligence was suggesting that it was desperately needed in immediate fashion. So certainly the hot wars we are seeing, not just in the Middle East, but also on the continent of Europe, have really provided a lot of impetus to get this done. The House Speaker himself said the intelligence he had seen recently really underscored to him that this was the right thing to do, that this aid did indeed need to be passed. And of course, it's a decision that Johnson had to make, decide to do the right thing, even if you potentially might lose your job as a result. That, of course, Ed, will remain to be seen.
Bloomberg's Kayleigh Lyons, and tune in to Balance Power later in the day for more updates. Thank you. Okay, now you'll never believe who is going viral. That's right. It's Taylor Swift. Swifties worldwide are gushing about the singer's new album, The Tortured Poets Department. The 16-song record dropped at midnight Eastern time on Friday. The singer then announced a surprise 2 hours later at 2 a.m. She had actually written a double album titled The Tortured Poets Department, The Anthology, with 15 additional songs. So there I am, in my vehicle, on my way to do Bloomberg Technology, and I got through the first 10. I'm not going to give my favorites just now, but check out social media. There are some interesting titles in there. Let's keep talking about it. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. A lot of headlines out of Washington, D.C., the Middle East. We are paying attention to the passage of the TikTok divest or ban bill as well. Recap on the pod. Listen to what Kayleigh had to say about the process in the coming 48 hours in Washington, D.C. Check out the pod on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and, of course, we publish all the Bloomberg platforms. It's been a week in the world of technology. Thanks for watching. This is Bloomberg Technology.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.